enjoyed things together. He and she were off together, and I remember seeing them getting out of the car laughing, and he had his arm affectionately around her, you know, and you could feel that there was an extraordinary loss. So I took a lot of, I guess we'd say, discipline guts, you know, to see it through, and she did that, and yet wrote these very beautiful, sensitive, very, very charming, really, articles, and then cut it off, never brought it up again. So I suppose that when we see these your kind of peripheral things, we don't do justice to Mary Frank. She was a Phi Beta Kappa, by the way, at University of Missouri. And she was the first person, I guess, to first woman to ever be invited to give a commencement address there, which she did.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So you have to see her in total. That's not the way the Wisconsin people saw her at the end.
No, that's the impression I've received.
Sort of like the end of the Alexandra. The Alexandra and the Tsar of Russia in the period of the 1917, at their downfall. It was almost not that extreme. But when things turn bad for the Duke and the Duchess, then everything went. And then they were less than peasants. And it was a very sharp downgrading. They were never as good for the university as their proponents in 1925 to 30 said. And they were never as much of a handicap for the university as he said in 1936 and 37. They weren't as good as they said, and they far were certainly bad as they said. Had it not been for the Depression, I think he would have weathered the storm. So he was really caught in that. I guess that about does it for me.
We get into all the many things you did as an administrator. There's just one other aspect of your student days I'd like to ask you about. What it was like to be a student here during the Depression, and how you feel the circumstances then were different from the way they are now. That's a big question, maybe.
I think I can go right into that.
Okay. Right in.
Right now, here we go. The student life on the campus here at Madison was so very different during the so-called Depression period, particularly in the early 30s, because of the inability of so many students to have what would actually be considered minimum financing. And yet, life did go on, the work did go on, and there was a considerable amount of student vitality. And in spite of the shortage of funds, student activities were generally fortified with funds when necessary. There was the junior prom that went on, that's any indication. There was a senior ball that went on. The attendance at the athletic contests was generally very good. And general enthusiasm actually would have to be considered as high. Yet, day after day, in case after case, one was aware of the extraordinary measures to which students went in order to make ends meet.
Could you give me some examples?
Yes. It was commonplace for men students to share in a cooking and not to have an apartment but to have a room. And they were allowed what would be called a hot plate. And I was in many of these rooms sharing information, working on a thesis, and working on some of the preparations for final exams, And where I, as a teacher in Madison and as a school principal, was allowed to live quite comfortably, I was constantly amazed at how these fellows allowed to shift, that did somehow make the adjustment with this hot plate and with the foods that they purchased. Some of them turned out to be very good cooks, and they also tended to be rather neat. Many of these apartments.
That surprises me.
Yeah, very surprising. They were quite good managers, and they somehow succeeded in being quite orderly in their dress. Certainly, those that I observed used a lot of good soap and hot water, and so where they may have had just very few clothes, the absolute minimum, they somehow were presentable. It was also always, I think, rather moving to see these fellows as they came up to their interviews and exams. They must have borrowed someone else's coat and someone else's tie, and they had maybe a shirt of their own, but they were quite presentable when they came in. And in those days, men, students did wear coats and jackets and white shirts and ties, and they were shaven. They were surprisingly orderly in many of these places that I visited. The girls were even more resourceful because they seemed to, they also had the rooms. And
now, these rooms, they are off-campus?
Off-campus rooms.
And this was allowed?
Yes, they did have them. I'm speaking now largely of graduate students.
Mm-hmm.
They did have that permission as graduate students. The undergraduates still were living, many of them, in the dormitories and in the fraternities and sororities, which were having great difficulties, the fraternities and sororities, during that period. But somehow, because they managed to buy things together in a unified, cooperative fashion, they did exist. And in the main, the major fabric of the fraternity, sorority life continued. In fact, it was quite strong, and as soon as World War II was over, they flourished. This was one of the better things done, perhaps, by late Dean Scott Goodnight, who recognized that many of the fraternities and sororities in the Depression would surely go under unless they had some cooperative buying. And the fraternities of the Greek letter societies did organize. They did have university help. They had supervision, and they did major buying, and it was much less cost. It was quite efficient. It was absolutely scandal-free, and done really through the Office of Student Affairs. I don't know if it's being done now, but it saved them. That was one of the prominent things. Still, too, with the students, there was almost a lightheartedness about the Depression period. Of course, they were young, they were strong, they were flexible, they didn't have any medical problems. There was a buoyancy in spite of the fact that there was very little cash at
hand. Mm-hmm. As it say.
But I was impressed, too, with the fact that no matter what kind of an event was going on campus, if they really wanted to attend, somehow they managed to attend. And so the basic structure of undergraduate and student life, and graduates too, went along in quite a normal pattern.
Whatever the effort it took.
Yeah, whatever it took, they somehow managed. There were cases where there was actually malnutrition, however, and where there was some degree of despondency, but it wasn't paramount. Loans were fairly common, but students were very cautious about loans. They didn't want to get deeply in debt. One of the things that was noticeable, again, this was the graduate student, when we compared with other universities, there were more research assistantships. There were more scholarship types available here, as we found in most of our neighboring universities. And the reason was Alumni Research Foundation. You see, it began to pour the funds in. And while $1 million now doesn't seem like much money for that backing, in 1933, 34, 35, 36, $1 million for teaching assistants, research assistants, was an enormous amount of money. And something else happened in that Depression period. Some of the men and a few of the girls, there weren't many girls doing graduate work then, mostly men.
I was going to get around to asking you about that.
Mostly men, became sort of the eternal scholar. They got a teaching assistantship. They had a stipend of $900 or $1,000 a year, and they made it almost a profession, being the eternal student. In fact, it became so commonplace that some of these men made it a way of life, that later the graduate committees had to have a termination. That is, there was a limit about how long they could be continuing to take graduate work. Many of these just did not do their PhD finals.
You're suggesting they didn't do it deliberately?
They deliberately held off the final doctorate exams. They held off the final dissertation because they had this $900 or $1,000 a year, and that just suited them fine.
They
could manage on it, and they liked the university life. They were sort of protected. They were away from the hard realities of the Depression life around the world. They had the library, they had their friends, they had their classes, they had a degree of status, and there were an enormous number in that group. In
a
fact,
really
they
large
became
number.
Yes, a large number, hundreds, and they became a problem. So the faculty was aware of it, and it was discussed at many of the research meetings, and actually out on the open floor of faculty meetings, that these fellows had to be pushed along, and they get out of the nest and move out and make the way for somebody else, that they were really just treading water, and no one was profiting from it. Well, I shouldn't say no one was profiting, because they were profiting, and they were often quite good teachers and quite devoted to their task. And many a professor was relieved of many of the chores because these perpetual graduate students and teaching assistants were there doing quite an honorable job and enjoying it.
I suppose in the course of time they piled up considerable experience and so forth.
And so here was a whole group that did not have automobiles, did not have a bicycle, they did not have any of the worldly goods, but they had a room and they had a hot plate, and occasionally would break through and spend elaborately for a breakfast at the student union. And they had endless conversations about endless philosophical topics with endless pipes and and an occasional beer. They were quite careful in their living. They had to be. But as one coming in from the full flow of life in community affairs and church affairs, governmental and public school, and coming onto the campus for seminars and working with these men, they became a very special group, which went on for several years. I would judge from around about 1932 until almost the beginning of World War II, this whole cluster was there.
Were they an intellectually sort of exciting, exploratory group?
Yes, they were. They could discuss endlessly topics that seemed to be rather irrelevant, but it was very interesting. And they did an enormous amount of reading. They were set aside. They were protected. They had their own little niches where they would be, and they had their own discussion groups, cutting across many academic lines. I'm sure they learned a lot. And they became very skilled in debate. I would have to point that out. As one came to the seminar with a report, these fellows were so adept and professional at pulling any report apart, whether it was a skilled professor, and certainly if it was another graduate student, and surely if it was someone like myself who came charging in from the world in the usual pattern of life, with the normal kind of a report for a seminar. These fellows with their skills would sit back and puff their pipes and listen, and then pretty soon they take it apart piece by piece by piece. And they were quite learned, and I was interested, in fact intrigued, with the vast amount of information they have, it seemed, on relatively unimportant things, but nonetheless interesting things. Yeah, they could debate for hours, weeks, months, and they enjoyed it. And their habit of life was different. Those of us that had jobs and had to be there in the morning and be there in the afternoon and report found their way almost sort of bohemian. These fellows had a class perhaps to help with, and they had papers to correct and that sort of thing. But they would often be up having their so-called bull sessions till 2 or 3 in the morning, and probably have a little break and then go back into it again. So their life in that respect was very casual. It doesn't exist now. It's all over.
Not in this sense, no. I imagine. And I wonder what became of them all when they were kicked out of the nest.
I would like to know. Actually, I've only followed 2 or 3, and they did well. And they were all somehow afraid to get married. That broke up their their pattern. Those added responsibilities of married life, that was something that they just surely did not want to get involved in.
That's interesting.
Yes. They stayed away from it, and I remember some of them were invited out to professors' homes where there were young ladies there. These fellows were pretty careful about not getting involved in any way. There was nothing about them that I think would indicate that they were different sexually and emotionally, but they were very careful to keep from being involved with the opposite sex or getting any responsibility for married life.
That is in contrast to
yes.
what happens today.
Yes, and then you see after World War II, you notice that that great difference of the GIs coming back with their wives and with 1 or 2 children, and with the tie to a family life under great difficulties, living in shacks and living in Quonset huts, but family life went on in such contrast to those perennial students that I knew before World War II. So it was a very sharp contrast. Not all of them were the perennial students. There were many that came, did their work, got their degrees, moved right on. But I think this whole block of students impressed many of us, as I say, who came from a more usual manner of life, to come onto the campus and to meet them in the seminars and to meet them in the classroom and meet them in the library. You could almost tell them with their clean shirts without ties, which was not too common then, and with the sweaters with leather at the elbows, and nearly always with the pipe, and a very slow and easy manner of talking and listening, and a little bit cynical, but also rather good-natured.
Was there, you mentioned that there were discussions in the faculty and so forth about how to cope with this.
Yes.
Was there any one definitive situation or time at which this seemed to do to have ceased?
It seemed to be over. At least it was declining rapidly just before World War II, in the late 30s. It was such a problem and so identifiable that it became a discussion in the open faculty meetings. And
was some action
was taken, yes. I can't specify the action in respect to the credit hours and the total years, but there was a minimum of credit hours that they would have to take, and there was a limit that was proposed of the time that they could spend from getting from a bachelor's degree to a master's, and from a master's to a doctorate. unless the faculty committee took some action. So they watched their progress, and if it wasn't rapid enough, they would be called in and followed up and be asked why, and there would be a case. And unless they had a full-time job somewhere, they would be told to either get it done or move out. And this became fairly common in the late 30s. After World War II, of course, there was no problem.
Situation completely changed.
Completely changed. Yes, that, as I think of the university graduate student of that day, those men that were here, and there are many bowl sessions, discussions, endless debates that they had, were a special group. How much good came of it, I don't know. Many of these fellows defended their way of life, by the way, saying that this was the heart of the great German universities and of Oxford and Cambridge, where the young scholars free to exchange and crossing the academic lines and disciplines, and a fermentation of new thought that came from the chance to be free for intellectual pursuits. I'm sure, however, that there was a lot of time lost, and there clearly there were many who were just afraid to move out from the nest.
Sounds like you're right, maybe. It's also, I guess, not a unique problem here. I think other
universities
sure this
of
that time must have had similar problems.
This was common across the country, but I'm sure it was probably more prominent at the major universities, which had big graduate schools.
That figures.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now maybe we could go on to your first days back here as a after the gap of time.
Yes.
When you came to assist Dr. Fred. And I'm not sure what you would like to start with. I would really like to know what things stand out with in your mind of your
I
first coming here.
That could be identified because they remain fresh after these 27 or 28 years. When I returned to Madison, after having been around the world as millions of others had been, and had come almost directly from China, and had no immediate touch with Madison except for about a day here on leave for 2 years, I was impressed with the vitality of the university, with the influx of the graduate students coming back and undergraduate students, really with the GIs who were here.
You sort of came with this mob, didn't
you?
I
came with the mob. I was a part of the mob. And the determination of on the part of the people of Madison and of the university administration and faculty and government to do very well by the GI. Given assistance financially, he was given assistance in his housing, socially, in all manner of ways. That was impressive, that they had arrangements for registration and arrangements for getting coursework outlined, for getting the GI benefits in such a very efficient fashion. It was that you could almost within a day you could get all of those details taken care of, because remarkably well done. I'm speaking now about the finances, about the books, about the payment of fees and checking in.
Can't
all
do
of
that
it.
Well today.
No, it was most expeditious. I also noted that there was a vigor and a drive to. On the part of the people of Madison to do well by finding, for one among many things, housing. And the buses in town, there were signs, open up a room, open up a place, bring in a GI. And on the radio, there were no TV in those days, but the radio pounded it. The local press had boxes, the State Journal and the Capital Times. Fill this out if you can house a GI. and send it in. And that was all down to then the Housing Bureau with Otto Miller and others did, I think, a superb job with that. And you felt that concern and care for the veteran, and that he was something special, and he deserved a lot of assistance, and it was done in a very dignified fashion. I was also noting the innovations that already before the war was really over, plans have been made to take over the some of the Quonset huts before they were actually through in their use in some of the Army camps. Tentative plans had been made to shift them back to the campuses around the country, and they were here. And that, well, I was part of that too. It was one of my first jobs, was to help.
Would you go into that a little bit?
It was to get them here. Well, but to finish that, there was the the ordinance, that's what it was. The Badger Ordinance, that was one of the very special ones. Here was a place 40 miles from Madison, near Baraboo, Wisconsin. And they took over a lot of that plant and the facilities that were there for housing, and actually bussed the GIs in the morning from the Badger Ordinance, 40 miles to the Madison campus, and in the evening, 40 miles back. At one time, there were over 2,000 living there with their families.
It You're talking about 2,000 students?
2,000 students.
Not mentioning their
not mentioning
wives
their
and
families.
Children.
No. It was
regular,
an enormous
small city.
Yes. Almost unbelievable how that all worked out, and worked out very well for several years.
Do you know any of the details of how this got going?
Well, this was done through the business office and through the Housing Bureau. They took over, made the arrangements with the federal government. There was, as far as I know, there was no charge at all except for the maintenance of those. This was turned over to the university complete, all of these houses that formerly took care of the munitions workers and their families.
And charge for the use of the property?
I don't think the university had to pay anything but a very nominal rental fee, just a few dollars. The students had to pay to live there, but it was very low, something like $25 a month for the housing. And something, I'm guessing, about $10 a month for the transportation. That was a way of life which brought attention to what could be done when you really had socialism at its best, because the girls up there, the young wives, dressed very modestly because everyone was on the GI Bill. And it would have been, unwise for a girl to be dressed, beyond that of the other girls who were there. They dressed very modestly. The men dressed comfortably but modestly. A lot of them still had army jackets and army shoes, and some of them even wore parts of a total uniform. So that was one which I noted immediately. All the planning that had gone into bringing up this whole Badger Ordinance place for the student housing. They called it Badger Village. And the good system that was developed, and the adjustments that the fellows made. Coming in the morning, they'd be studying. Going back at night, they usually played poker or bridge.
On the buses, you mean?
Oh, yes, on the buses. There's a lot of card playing at night, but not in the morning. Everybody was studying and working. And then the little enclaves that they had out there, little, I guess you'd almost call them study groups or workshops or even seminars, where those that had to get ready for an exam in physics would meet at a given barracks, and they would have a chance to go over their work. And some of the better students would help those that were having trouble. They do it with languages. They do it with the social studies. They do it with math. They had their really what amounted to prep and prep sessions. It was a way of life, went on for quite a while. So when I returned, then I found that the vitality and drive to win a war was turned over almost dramatically in Madison. by the community, the state, and the university totally to adjust to this new way of life, the new demands, and to do a first-class job with it. For the university had grown in size from, I think it was about 8,000 just at the end of World War II, to suddenly 18,000, all on one campus, an unheard of increase. And yet it went along, and in spite of all of the difficulties faced day by day by everyone, adjustments were made. I also was noting and impressed with the fact that many people who were teaching undergraduate courses did not even have a bachelor's degree in the need for instructors.
Is that true?
Yes.
Of course,
yes,
there must have been a terrific pressure to
great pressure and
get people to instruct us.
Of course, these were older people, that is, older in experience in their coursework and competence. They just did not have the degree, but they were reliable. They were not all good. There were many adjustments that had to be made for the almost incompetent person who was pulled in, but they were moved out quite rapidly. And in the main, the students did well, and the professors strained to meet the requirements. I felt for some of the older staff members that had been required to do with very little help all during the World War II period. They were here with inadequate staffs, having to meet daily adjustments, and now came this horde of vigorous young people from all over the world flowing onto the campus, and now they had another one to go through, and some of them seemed terribly tired, but yet they didn't complain. The spirit was, I think we'd have to say, an extraordinary demonstration of spirit and devotion, such as we hadn't had much before and perhaps might never have again. But you sensed it, and I was caught up in it when I came back.
What were your particular responsibilities in regard to all this?
I had several. One was to complete the job of getting temporary buildings from these army camps onto the campus, and to work with the architects and work with the buildings and grounds people representing the president's office. In fact, it wasn't a very lofty assignment, but I was given it by
Sounds
Dr.
necessary.
Fred. There were over 40 different Quonset huts and temp barracks to get them, and get them here within a matter of months. And so I started in about May of 1946 with the hope that by September of 46 we'd have all of those terrible looking things on and hooked up with electricity and the doors set and the windows set and ready to go into business. So that was one of my
How did
primary.
It work out?
We got them, and the students were at least given a chance for classes, and some of them that I told the Board of Regents when they asked me how long would they be up, I said I think we should certainly, with new buildings and all, have them all gone in 4 years. One is still standing, and we had many of them for 10 years. I would think that 10 to 12 years was the median for them.
I seem to recall that some temporary buildings have only come down the last year or so.
Yes, yes.
One
That's
in particular.
Right. One of the ROTC building is just down, and so that was
one of the last.
T-20 was there. Yes, that was one of my first jobs, and the second was to work with the legislature. I hadn't done much of that before, in fact, practically none. But we had to interpret the matter of faculty-student ratios. And I recall that as a specific assignment, to be sure that the Joint Finance Committee and the Education Committee and the Governor understood the significance of a proper ratio, and I was compiling facts about that. I also was something of an ombudsman, listening to student complaints. They wanted to see the president. Well, of course, you couldn't all see the president. And these fellows that had in World War II to go through a sergeant or go through a company commander and go through a battalion commander and go through then an army officer in the higher echelons, didn't want to do that anymore. Now they were here as a student and they wanted to see the top man at once. They'd had their fees, they had their rights, they had their privileges and their status, and nothing was to deter them. So I spent in 1946, 47, and 48 a considerable amount of time intercepting them and listening to them. And it helped greatly for them to know that I had been in the same situation with them for 4 years. I think had I not had the experience of an enlisted man and an officer in overseas duty, and with all of the blankety-blank problems, as they put it, that are inherent in it, it would have been difficult. And to understand the deep frustrations, of course we never understood them well enough, but the pressures that they were under. So much time was in that. And then there was a need to tell about the university, alumni, and to supporters of the university and the critics of the university, because we were such a big part of Madison and of the state. So I gave a good many speeches. I don't know how good they were. We did the best we could to interpret this whole new way of life for a big university meeting many emergencies. So I did interpret it for civic groups, and for governmental groups, and for alumni, and the students tended to call. They'd asked the president to come and meet with them. He very properly said that he was working 14 to 15 hours a day and he couldn't meet with them. Some big groups, some small groups. So I was delegated almost daily to meet with some small group somewhere on the campus. And I really enjoyed it. But you never felt that you gave all of them an adequate answer. You did a fair amount of listening. And I did learn, as many in public life have learned, that if you'll just listen patiently, half of the problem seems to be settled. And so I spent probably a third of my days just listening, and usually to complaints.
Well, I suppose there's something to the feeling that people with complaints want to be heard.
Yes, and a lot of them were justified. We had a delegation of wives come in, the young women who whose husbands were attending the classes, and these brides of the GIs came in to see the president, and I met with them, and they said that these this temporary housing we put out in what is now Midvale Boulevard, out near there, which is was out near the farm, now the East Hill Farms, which is the Midvale Shopping, the Hilldale Shopping Center. Mm-hmm. It was flooding in the spring, and the water was coming up high, and it was not only inconvenient, but it was dangerous for the little children, because some of this water was deep. That seems impossible now, but that was the situation. And so that did seem bad enough. And we did go out to see it, and Dr. Fred went out with me, president, and we got buildings and grounds to see it. Well, this was on city property, part of it. It wasn't university property entirely, but we got the city engineers, we got the university engineers, we got buildings and grounds, we got some of the fellows themselves out there, and we rerouted the water. And this seems ridiculous now, but we spent a lot of time getting drainage for these places where they had these temporary living conditions. And students were generally very patient about it too, but they were right in coming. And so we not only listened, but we did some things. We probably should have done a lot more.
Well, one could always say that, yeah. I guess.
GI came. He had maturity and he had great determination, and he did very well academically.
Well, he had all the drive that.
That's right.
And was feeling a little bit at a disadvantage in terms of the people who hadn't gone.
That's right.
And he had time to make up.
That's right. And he
to catch up.
He had to do it because he felt it in a hurry. Some of them actually finished their with the summer sessions. We had a summer semester.
It came up fairly early in Dr. Fred's presidency, as I understand, was the disagreement and general hassle over Howard McMurray, which
that was
involved
memorable.
The faculty and the regents and so forth. And I wonder if you'd tell me what you remember about that.
Indeed, that was one of the first major events that I came across in my first year. In fact, it was significant enough to make an impression that was strong in respect to the regents, in respect to President Fred, the faculty, and some of the internal workings of this elaborate machinery that we go about in finally selecting a member of the staff. As I recall it, Howard McMurray had been on the staff as in political science and left to run for Congress. And when he ran for a second time, he had agreed that that would be it. Or put it another way, he said that if given his assignment in political science after his first ventures in running for office, he would not run again. That was the understanding of the regents, anyhow. But nonetheless, he did run again. And then he was defeated and subsequently came back to the university saying, now I wish to be reappointed or reassigned in political science. The details are a bit confusing, but at any rate, the committee in the Department of Political Science did recommend that he be appointed. And the dean approved, after it had gone through the social science division, they had all approved. Professor von Kuchen was then chairman of the Department of Political Science, and he spoke regularly and with considerable vigor about the importance of this appointment going through. While it was being shadowed by and put under question by the discussions in the press and statements by several of the regents that this man had no right to come back after he, in effect, had broken his word with the university by running for office after he said he wouldn't do it. Dean Ingram must speak for himself on it, but it was my impression that he wasn't very happy with his duties as he had them done, as he saw them, which were to stand by the faculty recommendation. He did. He recommended that Howard McMurray be given an assignment as a professor in political science. The regents delayed this for a while with the full hearing to come up in the January meeting of 1947. President Fred then was clearly in the middle. Here was the faculty and a distinguished dean of letters and science saying that this man was to be appointed. He met the requirements as they saw it. While he knew that the regents would undoubtedly oppose. So in late December, the president suggested that some of us who were close to him make our analysis about what we thought ought to be done. For this was really the first critical showdown for President Fred with his governing board. He still was a relatively new president, and so many would be watching, as they would under any circumstances, but especially when this was President Fred's first major test in backing up his faculty. I recall that after much consideration, when he allowed me to bring in a recommendation, I tried to work out the pros and the cons of the case. It seemed to me that the weight was in favor of appointing, or at least recommending, that Mr. McMurray be given the assignment. The things in favor of it were, first of all, the president was the chief spokesman for the faculty. They had examined the case carefully. It had indeed been sifted and shaken down. And if Dean Ingram believed that it should be, and those who worked closely with McMurray felt that he had the qualifications, then in spite of the difficulties, it would be best for the president to stand with the faculty, with his dean, with the total staff, and recommend it to the regents. Also in favor, I remember that it seemed to me that while the regents might turn it down, certainly a president couldn't expect to have all of his recommendations carried out by the regents, and so he would lose one. But he would win one, certainly, in respect to his own family. And it seemed to me as I came back that this was tremendously important, that he be not only the spokesman, but he be the spokesman with the highest degree of dependability that he could have in respect to his relations. So the faculty would trust him. After all, he was one of theirs. He'd been on the faculty. He'd been a dean. The faculty wanted him to be president. And if this was their wish, and there wasn't enough really against McMurray, he seemed kind of a rascal to me in some respects, but there wasn't really enough against him for the president to say no. In respect to why he should not be for it, but go along probably with the regents, was after all, he was indeed the chief executive. He didn't have to take all of the recommendations of the faculty or what was a president for. He had the right as the chief executive to examine, to weigh, to test, to get the total view, the broad view, the perspective of one who worked with government, worked with the governing board, worked with the faculty, worked with the public. After all, he had and should have had about the broadest view of the total situation of anyone. And then, or therefore, if in light of all of that, he felt that McMurray should be not be appointed, he certainly had every right to say so. And further, he would have the regents undoubtedly grateful to him for making that recommendation, because then they, the governing board, could stand with the chief executive of the university. I did do some more summarizing, but my final was pretty clear when I was asked for it, that it would seem wisest to stay with the faculty, and with all of the reluctance that one might have, let him get the assignment. And then, in the meantime, do everything possible to get two or three of the regents to come through to say that, with their misgivings still, to stay with the president and stay with the faculty. For if we had a split vote, it wouldn't be nearly as difficult for the president in the future as if it was a unanimous vote of all of the governing board. So
it wouldn't, in other words, be quite such a confrontation.
No, not quite such a confrontation. If he could have some on the regent speaking for the president or following his lead and following the lead of the faculty. We did work with several of the regents. I remember that two or three were close to the president, did some calling. I'm
Do
sure
you remember
that,
which ones they were?
Yes. The president talked to Mr. Camel from Oshkosh, who was on the regents, and he seemed ready to go along. We talked with Mr. Callahan, who was the state superintendent of public instruction, and he agreed that he would go with the president. And also with Dan Grady from Portage, who'd been on the regents on and off for several years, was a trial lawyer and a very winsome and colorful Democrat and a leader of those who defended Glenn Frank years before. Something of a liberal. He was agreed to stay with it and to make the recommendation. So there were a couple others who were possibilities. And near the end, just the day before the Regents' meeting, it appeared that we might actually have a 5-5 split, which of course would have helped enormously. Rather than have unanimous vote against the president's recommendation, have a 5-5 split, it would have taken a lot of the heat off. But a Mickey Cleary, who was not the president of the board at the time, but a dominant member, the then president of the Northwestern Mutual Life Insurance Company, a man of great strength of character and persuasion, and an extraordinarily forceful man, gave a long, well-defined, clearly stated documentation, which he read with great fervor, about why this man had defaulted, why McMurray had gone back on his word, why the Regents and the university had no responsibility, had no obligation whatever in putting him back on the staff. And when he had finished that document, with his occasional pounding of the table, with a voice that got higher and higher and shriller until he was almost shaking with emotion, I thought to myself, wow, if they can vote against that, this will be one for the Medes and the Persians. And it turned out that we did lose one or two of those votes that were,
we thought
we might have. And I think the final vote, therefore, was 7-3. 7 against the appointment and 3 in favor of the appointment. Of real significance, though, is what happened right afterward. Immediately after the meeting, I vividly recall how the Regents on both sides of the question came up to Dr. Fred and told him that he'd done the thing that they knew he had to do. He had to stay with his faculty. There was no doubt of that. And Mickey Cleary came up to offer him his hand, and others came through and said, well, I want to see you later, E.B., and were most solicitous. The faculty, I don't really feel, were quite so concerned about McMurray as a personality, as a professor, as a researcher, teacher. I think they were more interested in winning the point. It was the issue of the freedom to recommend. It's the academic community, the community of scholars being allowed to have their own. I think that was the issue. But since there was the open discussion, there were two points of view, and President Fred, Dean Ingram stayed with them, they seemed to feel that all that could have been done was done. And the matter seemed to drop immediately, except that for the next several months, absolutely anything that President E.V. Fred brought to the Regents was not only approved, but with acclamation. And those that were against the McMurray appointment seemed to go far out of their way to say, now we think, President Fred, that's an excellent recommendation. That's well prepared, and I'm enthusiastic about the manner in which you have done this. And so he had the President Fred had the faculty for him, he had the administration with him, and he had the Regents with him, and I think finally the general public felt that he had defended academic freedom, but probably the Regents were right. The press was mixed on it. The Capital Times locally was strong for the appointment. The State Journal was against the appointment. The Milwaukee Journal, I don't recall their view. But surely if any man walked into a very tough situation or any administration and came out smelling like a rose, that was it. And so I was among those that learned rather early in the game the strength and the power of the faculty of the University of Wisconsin and their intense desire to have their president be one of the family and speak for them and, if need be, fight for them. For the scars were there of the days when they felt that Dykstra could not do the job for them. And his predecessor at the end, Glenn Frank, could not do it. So now here was the new day. And they felt an enormous need to have this kind of a presentation, this kind of a president, this kind who really was built into the very warp and the woof of the whole university idea of a community of scholars. It made quite an impression on me.
You seem to be suggesting that the, to a certain extent, this particular incident sort of set the tone for President Fred's
Very much so.
Years as president.
And so for the next dozen years, I'm sure that was the was almost the overwhelming impression as I got about the campus and around the state and around the nation, that Dr. Fred was one who, with perception, with discretion, and if need be, with willingness to fight, defend academic freedom, but did it with dignity and did it without making it a national issue to puff himself up. It was done only as the modest, low-keyed spokesman who only when necessary would come down to fight for an issue. But when it was needed, he was always there. And the faculty were very grateful for it.
Do you happen to recall what became of McMurray? I've never heard.
No, I think that's important to note, that after he left here, I think he went to New Mexico. I think he became a professor there, but he didn't shake the world, and he was not clearly one of the nation's outstanding political scientists, at least as we judge it from here. Now, maybe if we had been to the place where he was, it would have been different, but there were no books of considerable importance or papers. He was just run of the mind.
So in terms of the university, it didn't appear to be an irreparable loss.
No, and I think that it needs to be noted that there was no clamor afterward, we need McMurray back, let's start the fight over again. It died. And it died very completely. No one was wanting to make another commitment or another major issue.
Well, that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Because there could have, that situation could have
yes.
come up, I suppose.
Yes, in some universities, that sort of thing, this goes on for many years. Well, of course, this was a bit different, but when John Bascom was in fact fired by the university, our history recordings are replete with the many who felt it was such an unfortunate loss for the university, the whole situation unfortunate, and he was brought back here with considerable acclaim and had a huge convocation out of doors with people coming from many miles and students from several generations to listen, to applaud, and to cheer. So people have been brought back, and some have followed through. But not in the case of McMurray. It might be well as just a little supplement to indicate that I'm sure that while Dean Ingram was spokesman for Letters and Science, and a strong spokesman, therefore, for McMurray, that Ira Baldwin, then Dean of the College of Agriculture and a confidant of the president, certainly had much to say about this in the quiet meetings with the president. And I'm sure that A.W. Peterson, the director of business affairs, later to be vice president of business, had much to say about it. In fact, I think that Pete, as we called him, also wrote a memo about the pros and the cons. And I'm sure that from what he told me, that his conclusion was that the president should not approve the McMurray appointment, that in light of his long relationships which he would have with the regents, he had every right to say no, that McMurray didn't deserve it, and that this was a time the president could very clearly and conscientiously stay with the regents.
Have you any ideas as to Ira Baldwin's position?
I do not know.
I'll have to ask him.
You'll have to ask him. No, I don't know how he felt on that. I'm sure it was very wise observation, but I'm certain of this. I'd have to tell Ira, I know that he had all aspects of the case up on the table for review before a decision was made by the president.
Now, one of the important events in the university's history, which took place, I gather, fairly soon after you came, was the centennial celebration. And I noticed from a list which I looked over that you were on the committee for this.
Yes, indeed. President Fred saw to it that some of us who were closely allied with him were on that centennial committee. And actually, it was a very useful experience, especially having come to the university just 2 years before. Many things were new, and I felt that this working with the University Centennial Committee not only opened up avenues of the past, but for the present, because I learned to work with the people who were carrying a major responsibility for the university. And all in all, I would have to rate it as one of the better experiences in my many years with the university, because we had a good leader in Wild Bill Kiekhofer as the chairman. We had the development of the University of Wisconsin history with Curdy and Carstensen, and the events on the campus were uniformly well done. It was all accomplished with quite a degree of dignity and goodwill. It was fairly low key. There were no great dramatic events. We had, for example, seminars on the shape of education today and the responsibilities for universities in the future. The impressive thing to me about the seminars and discussion groups was the emphasis on the university and the strength and responsibility it must develop and assume for the future. We did indeed have the celebration of the past, but fortunately the committee saw through some of the pitfalls that would be there if it was all on just talking of yesterday and years back. And fortunately, did look to not only the next 10 years, but to the next total generation. And I think that brought an added enthusiasm, and I think it gave a better perspective to have us not only think of the past and the present, but a good sharp look at the future. I, as a member of the committee, found that there was considerable dedication. We had regular meetings, probably once a week, and it was all done with a very modest sum of money. I think it was probably not much more than $15,000, which seems like a pittance today. That doesn't include, of course, the history. But the events were carried on with dispatch. We had distinguished people here, Graham, North Carolina president, and many others that came in to give very vigorous statements and participated with all with not only enthusiasm but with a very real dedication to where we were trying to determine where we were going. And the president of Illinois came. I thought he did a superb job. And all in all, the speakers came not only to make a presentation, but somehow, not only because I was on the committee, but my recollection is that they prepared carefully and well, and it was clearly their own thinking. It was not something done by a speechwriter. or they opened up for questions afterwards. This was something new in that day, to open up for an open forum, and many did. And it was clear that they were prepared well, and that they made many statements that were not only kindly about the university and its impact on the state, the Midwest, the nation, and the world, but some of them were really exuberant that the University of Wisconsin had a quite unique place in shaping the trends for a state university in service to a people. That it, they, time after time, the speakers emphasized that, that this university broke new ground, and that other universities now had assumed that that was the kind of responsibility they should have, to take the learning and the results of the findings of the laboratory, the classroom, the libraries, and bring it into the life of agriculture, industry, business, commerce, the humanities, the total life of the state. But they ended up saying, in nearly every case, Wisconsin did it first. And the national publications were strong, Newsweek, Time, the New York Times, gave fine tributes to the University of Wisconsin, recognizing its 100 years and indicating that it had a lot of turmoil, that it had been out on the firing line of new ideas, that had shaped many of the concepts of not only university's service to a state, but it's the service that it gave to shaping and testing new ideas. And emphasis was given to men such as Commons and Ely. In the early days, they took a long look back and then talked also about Ed Whitty, who had a major part in developing the Social Security program. So not just agriculture and engineering and business and those things which indeed are important, but in the social structure of the state and the nation. And I recall that they did emphasize two statements made by Teddy Roosevelt when he came here, when he was serving then as president, and indicated that the University of Wisconsin was really the testing ground for new ideas in government for the nation. So we've helped buoy it up, and the Founders Day, that is the alumni meetings around the nation, gave much attention to it. And again, while there were no great parades or huge band concerts and a lot of gimmicks of medals and all, there was a consciousness on the part of all alumni that it was 100 years, which not only were significant, but opened the way to whole new vistas that we could not then perceive. As I look back in the last 25 years, now we've had 25 years beyond that 100.
So we're now celebrating our 125th,
yes, aren't we, this year? Yes, our 125th. Many of these statements and many of those, the prophecies, are really borne out. Perhaps I should read a lot of these documentations and read the extracts of those speeches again. But my memory is clear about the university not only had a big job in the past, and at that time of 1949, but it was going to have even more complex and demanding jobs on a much broader scale for the future. And how right they were. They couldn't have foreseen the Sea Grant program that is now underway, bringing many disciplines together and have a real impact on bringing about clean water for the state, for the nation, maybe the world. Or about the work in meteorology that was just getting in on the way then. But now we find it written up in Fortune magazine this last month, the whole feature of meteorology, indicating probably this development on the Madison campus may very well be the finest in the United States, and that was just a little one 25 years ago. Or the work in poverty, or the work in environment, broad scale. Many of these things that were pointed to as possibilities for service have really come about. So as I review then and recall these statements about the University of Wisconsin and the coming generation have been pretty well borne out, more than the people that knew that made these statements.
Oh, that's pretty nice.
It is. And I think that more and more now they're doing this on in these centennial programs or celebrations. They're talking about the significance of it all for tomorrow, rather than just a jubilee of celebrating the past. And I think that Bill Kuechhofer had a lot to do with it. I think Curdy had a lot to do with that, Merle Curdy. He too, as a historian, felt that if this was to have a significance for the state, we ought to look for tomorrow. As I traveled around the state that year and speaking at many of the University Alumni Founders Day programs, I could sense that this was really a time of warm feeling for the university. I don't believe that at any time since there has been quite, at least in my experience, such gratitude for the university, such pride in it by the thousands of people that attended these meetings who had never gone here, but looked at it as a place that was more than a collection of buildings or scholars and students, but a kind of spirit that represented the best that Wisconsin had. Now, we had a lot of things going for us that were just really a good break, and certainly among them was the fact that we had the veterans here, 10,000 on the campus, everyone wanting to do something for them, and that we found by 1949 that they were doing very well, better than expected, doing exceptionally well academically. They were governing themselves well. There was a good drive and sense of purpose. There was family atmosphere with the veterans with two or three little kids, and there was a community feeling. So I think that helped to highlight the part of the university in the whole ongoing story of a state and a nation.
In other words, the centennial happened at a fortuitous time.
You said it precisely. If we'd had the centennial when we had some of these protests on campus and strikes, and at a time when the enchantment of higher learning was not quite as strong, we may not have had the full vigor that we had, and again, the goodwill statewide that we experienced.
You mentioned giving speeches around the state. Did you do a considerable amount of that?
Yes, I did it, partly because President E.B. Fred wanted to do it only when absolutely necessary. And so I found that about a year or two after I came here, that he was telling them that he couldn't come, but there was a man here that worked with him and would be very available and at no cost.
I see.
And so one thing led to another, and soon I was doing a considerable amount of it, maybe too much. I felt after a review of 4 or 5 years of it that I was going excessively, that it would be better to spend my time persuading other people to go. And so that was the approach we made. I think it was better. I should have done it earlier, to spend more time persuading deans and professors of distinction and some of the younger ones who had something new to say, to urge them to go out. And finally, I think by about 1955, we had as many as 50 in sort of an unofficial stable who, when called upon, would, if they could, go out. And it was very gratifying. But I should have done it earlier. In the first 2 or 3 years, I had sort of a false concept that they wanted me. Well, they really didn't. And a few places, people I knew did. They actually wanted President Fred. And then later, they wanted someone who could speak with authority on a field in which there was considerable interest, some conflict, and in which there was enough basic material to be of significance to a major section of the state.
I looked at a list of committees of special projects about the centennial, and it seems to me, I counted quickly, or something in the nature of 37 different committees. Did these groups organize exhibits or just seminars and visiting lectures?
Well, of course, the most significant one, clearly, was the history of the university, which we mentioned.
Well, that must have been planned in advance,
but
because
that was planned
it took
well
a while
in
for them
yes.
to write such a book.
I don't know just when they started. They were doing it surely before, before World War II was over. That'd be my guess, that around 1945, they were underway. Certainly they were underway in 1947, because they had the first one volume out in 1949, as I recall. I'm sure they did. One volume was out there.
Yes, I think the second came out of
Now, these right. other committees did many things. They had exhibits. I remember Professor Glenn I had one on the University of Industry. There were at least two in agriculture. There were some, at least one, and perhaps several, as I look back on it, in medicine. There were several in education. We had them in economics. And these gave attention to development of a story for exhibits on campus, exhibits at Milwaukee, too, at the arena.
Oh.
There was one there. But most of it was in the publications, such as the newspapers. We had a lot of press, and it was generally very good. And because of that goodwill that was generated there, because there wasn't the competition for space in higher education, the university got a lot of print. And after all, this is the state university, and the 100 years was pointed out as a time of special consideration.
I did read something about an art exhibit. That,
Yes, there was. And Jim Watrous had a key role in that. And Professor Hagen. And we did have that art exhibit developed. In fact, it was one of the highlights. I'd be remiss not to say that, to mention that. There were some of the great paintings from some of the distinguished galleries which were brought here, and they were on exhibit at the University Memorial of Union.
And we didn't have the
Albion Art Center then. And in fact, there was a major insurance problem I remember our committee had to face. Bill Kiekhofer was strong for it, but we did find the money, and I think we got region funds for that. I'm quite sure we did. And it was a huge insurance program to get these some of the finest pieces from the Metropolitan Gallery in New York. I can't recite right offhand, Jim Watrous could, where they came and all, but it was given special attention by not only the people in art, but the general public. Actually, I think it was one of the factors in bringing about the LVM Art Center.
Do you?
Yes. This was 1949, and it was pointed out that we did not have an art center, that we needed one, and here we had to import, we had to borrow, we didn't have an adequate place to display these treasures. And I'm sure that in the minds of regents, the public, the legislators, and certainly alumni, we have highlighted the need for an art center. And of course, Jim Watrous and others were pushing it hard. But
But this made it very definite and very tangible.
I imagine security would have been a problem, too.
It was.
Such valuable paintings.
Mm-hmm. They brought some of their own security people with them.
Did they?
Yes. I think we had at least three people, three guards, that were there to supervise the other guards. On the matter of the art, that's something that Jim Waters should manage. He would know all of the details.
Well, maybe I'll have an opportunity to ask him.
I said we didn't have any medals and banners. We did have a medallion, and it's a good collector's item right now. I think I have one at home. So they sold them and made a little money on them. So it made everyone happy.
So it can help.
I suspect before closing on this, I'd have to comment on the total university effort, administration, faculty, and students. There was a considerable unity and commitment to this. We worked on it long in advance, and the Daily Cardinal, the local press, meetings here, all were not only conscious of the centennial, but hundreds, even thousands of people had a hand in doing something about it, make it go.
Well, that must have helped its
yes, it
reception,
did.
Too.
Yes, it did. I couldn't give too much credit to Bill Kiekhofer, who is not only a popular teacher, professor, but one who had kept ties with an enormous number of people and alumni throughout the United States. And so this highly respected, warm-hearted, enthusiastic older man who was kept alive and alert and highly active would get a good response. When he wrote to someone or called someone, they come right back and generally volunteer. So he was a good promoter. I don't think they could have picked anyone better, for he had a feel not only for the history and for the impact of the university on society, but for the humanities and the fine arts too. He was a good central figure to give it drive and give it direction.
Just one question. Other than
he also made me work very hard.
That's what I was getting at. Other than giving speeches, what was your particular activity in regard to all this?
It was largely in arrangements. We had many personalities coming to the campus and to see that the details were cared for with their arrangements, that they got here on time, and that they were assured that it was important, and to bring as much university spirit as you could to every activity that went on. To also help with the financial arrangements and to help with the general planning for the exhibits and places where we met. In fact, also in the press, I guess along with Clay Schoenfeld, who was sort of our executive secretary, I somehow, at Dr. Fred's recommendation, got involved in practically every phase of the total centennial. That's the way he wanted it. And we also kept, however, a lot of this action and planning and administrative detail out of the president's office. We had a special room set aside, and we tried to confine all of the details to that centennial room. It was a wise thing to do. In fact, I had to be talked out of it. I thought it would have been better to do it all through the president's office. But I could see later that it was a good recommendation to separate it from the president so that he could step in when he wanted to and not clutter up the office with all the other things that had to be done.
That seems to make sense. How personally involved did he did President Friend
Oh, he was concerned about it every day in the planning for at least, I think, 2 years in advance. He was involved. See, he had just come in 1945, and this came in 1949. So shortly after he became president, there was a talk about having a centennial observance of some with a major effort. He looked in on our meetings, but at all of the major convocations, at the forums, at the seminars, at the Founders Day programs, he was there. So he was well identified with it. Although he didn't do a lot of speaking, he was there to receive people, to introduce them, and to, let us say, as the church, give them the right hand of fellowship. Representative then from Faculty, Student Life, and Interest Committee were united in the feeling that there were no regulations would be violated if this meeting was held on campus, the Free Cuba Group. So they did. We were also alerted by our campus police, protection security, that there might be a major protest on the part of fraternities and sororities, particularly the fraternities. We said, in spite of that, it ought to go on. Well, there was the protest. And just as the meeting was getting underway on the steps of the union, probably about 400 or 500 there was a big influx of students from Langdon Street, from the fraternities, I would think 400 or 500, calling out insults and heckling these students that were proposing the Free Cuba Enterprise. Right or wrong, I suggested that rather than have it in the open, we have it in the Union Theater.
You suggested this on the spot?
On the spot. Two quarter butts. And he said, yes, he said, if you will be responsible. And so I allowed them to go in. And they did go into the theater, and then I asked the president of the student government to take over, since I didn't think that a dean of students should be there moderating, and suggested that there be 5 minutes for one position and 5 minutes for the opposition, and that they go on and have about 6 total speakers, 3 on one side, 3 on another, and then that the moderator allow written questions to come from the crowd, and that all of it be over within 1 hour. They held pretty well to that recommendation. But the stirrings were there of the liberal students and the conservative students, and moving into a national issue, you could feel that this was something that was going to continue. There was a noisy session. It was, I think, fairly useful, covered quite fairly by the media. But when it was over, there were several of us who were there, and since I was immediately responsible, I told Porter Butts that I didn't think we should ever try to do it quite that way again. If we're going to have a session like that, we needed to be very carefully structured. We needed to know exactly who was going to speak, or how it was going to be handled. We didn't have to know who was going to speak, but we had to have a format. And I doubted if we could just go in as a big mob, like I allowed them to go into the Union Theater, because anything could have happened there. Fortunately, we came out of it quite well, but the stirring was there. You could feel the tensions, you could feel the anger, you could feel the bitterness, and you could also sense the ignorance. A lot of people were talking about Cuba and didn't know what the issues were. And a lot of people were talking about communism and didn't know what the issues were. But the seeds were there for the protests and the riots that came up on different topics, mostly the military, in just 2 to 3 years later they started.
Do you feel that the census was sort of the beginning?
I felt it was the beginning. There may have been other things, but I think the free Cuba discussion and the near violence, the anger, the bitterness, and the sharp division of the group represented the beginning of the riots and protests that reached their peak in 1970.
Well, perhaps we ought to go on and talk a little bit about the riots and protests and those sit-ins that took place in the mid-60s.
Well, there was the, back again, the fraternities. It seems rather peaceful now. But they decided to march. They decided to march in defense of the Delta Gamma. So fraternities and sororities on a very rainy day marched all the length of Langdon Street. There must have been 1,000 of them. Very orderly, but very serious, and brought a proclamation to the from the basketball, which I received. And the proclamation being that we at the university should allow Delta Gamma to continue, even if the national charter was not changed. That the local group were free, they were open, they were non-discriminatory, and we at the university should be strong enough and broad-minded enough to allow them to continue. But this was one of the first marches of the kind. Later, of course, they got rough and they got very difficult to handle and became really mobs. This was orderly. But again, you could feel, this was about 1960, 61, you could feel the mood now of marching and taking action. If letters to the editor and art and editorials wouldn't do, then do something else. Marching was a way. There was also the protest about ROTC on the campus. In about 1961. This was very sharp. There was a meeting on the lower campus in front of the library. And President Elbium was invited to come down to speak to the group about why we should continue ROTC on campus. There were speakers there who protested ROTC, that it was outmoded, that no part of a university life. It taught only the militarism. It brought death, brought destruction. It was something of the past that we should be ashamed of. The whole military effort. And ROTC was a symbol of that blasphemous military war effort. President Elbium did not choose to go. He rather had me read his statement. And I did read the statement in which he defended not only the right of the university to have ROTC, but pointed out that we were compelled to have it as a land-grant university, at least to offer it. This was not received very well, of course, by those who were there to protest. The people there were not for ROTC. They were against it. But again, with the roar of that crowd that was not like one of those violent ones in 1965, 67, 68. But again, you could feel the development of a protest spirit that was not going to be down just by a statement, even by the president of the university.
Do you feel it all began as early as that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I felt it was beginning then in 1960, 61. So you had the requests for more freedom in the housing, more freedom of speech on the part of students, the breaking down of the requirements of a national charter for fraternities and sororities, and then students moving into international affairs, and then questioning ROTC. All of these things together indicated that there was something moving and it wasn't going to stop in a day or two. You could feel that the structure was being built for a major conflict. and we had it.
Well, I was going to say, we know what happened. Would you talk about what didn't happen at all?
The first real difficulty was about 1965. This is growing all the while.
Was this the Dow Chemical protest?
Dow Chemical protests. When students protested the Dow Chemical people being on the campus.
Is there recruiting?
To recruit students for service with the Dow Chemical, because the Dow Chemical was making napalm. I don't know how we pronounce it now. We pronounce it napalm then. Which burned and disfigured children and civilians as well as the military in Vietnam. They requested that a group of students, so-called liberals, not necessarily liberals, I think the term is unfortunate. I think we just have to say protesters, requested the chancellor then, Bob Fleming, to deny Dow Chemical a right to be on campus. And in that request and in their protest, they took over the chancellor's office. This is pretty well documented by a lot of press at the time.
This was a sort of famous sit-in.
That's right. And they did. They just came in and they did sit in. I think that Chancellor Fleming handled it very well. I don't know if he'd do it the same way again, but he negotiated with them. And he did have a degree of rapport with them. He seemed to understand what they were after. And I think he surprised them often by anticipating what they were going to say and anticipating their point of view. He, too, was against the Vietnam efforts in Vietnam. He, too, felt that it was a mistake and said so. So he aligned himself with them on that score. But he did say that the university work had to go on. And he said that they could not take over, and he did call for protection and security to assist him. There were arrests, there was some roughness, but I don't think over 200 students were involved. So here in this big campus, you still had just a relative handful of students involved. But again, it was a symbol, it was a representation. It was a breaking through for the more violent things that were to come.
Well, as I recall, not only was there the sit-in, but also there was something called a teach-in. Something
yes.
A certain number of the faculty were involved in this.
Mm-hmm. Well, now the faculty, it's a good point, because the faculty became more and more involved. The faculty became not only interested in what the students had to say, but they began to attend the sessions. And the students wanted a sit-in, or a teach-in, where the teachers would volunteer their time to discuss Vietnam, the role of the United States in Vietnam. And these teach-ins were very well attended, and some of them went all night. Actually, my opinion is that they released a lot of the tensions. Students wanted something to do, like the first marches that were just by the fraternities and sororities, very peaceful and decorous. And now you got up into 1965 and 66, and they wanted something to which they could really belong, and so they could possibly make another sacrifice. And at this time, too, there came along with the teach-ins, the marches to the Capitol. There were meetings at the field house, and then there were torchlight parades or candlelight parades. Not torchlights, candlelight, peace parades to the Capitol. Some of them got out of hand a bit, but not bad. So again, there was movement, marching, and the numbers would grow and grow as they got up to the Capitol and came back. And of course, there were those that clearly looked for the police to make a mistake. As soon as the police billy clubs came out, that's just what was looked for. Then they could point out that they were being martyrs, they were sacrificing, and that the police brutality was a part of the horrible establishment. The national defense, the military, and the police all in league against the freedom of human beings, especially those that wanted to defend the poor children and the old of Vietnam. It came about that way. Then in 1967 came the kind of a protest that all of us worried about. I was among them that worried about what would happen if there was a taking over of a building by a major group and the police moved in and began to swing the clubs. I was afraid, too, that since police had pistols on their hips, that there could be firing, that there could be someone killed or seriously wounded.
What kind of relation did the university administration have with Madison Police? I mean, there is the University Protection and Security Group. Under what conditions would the Madison Police have been, or the National Guard, or what have you, been summoned?
The police and the Dane County, City Police and Dane County Sheriff's Group were called in only when Protection and Security felt they could not manage the situation. Protection and Security were there first, and we had we still have a quite remarkable fellow, Ralph Hansen, who became something of a folk hero as Director of Protection and Security for the Madison campus. He was very low-key, courageous, walked right into the crowd. He was friendly, was humorous, but firm. He was able to stand heckling. He was able to develop rapport with the leaders. He got respect from the crowd. In fact, they all called him Ralph, and at the end, rather affectionately, because he was dignified, friendly, open, direct. They knew he had a job to do, but he did it with decency and with even a sense of humor. Big fellow, physically, clearly unafraid, and he was never touched, but much respected. I think he did a lot to keep these things in hand, but he and his small staff, when faced with hundreds and hundreds who were angry, belligerent, he couldn't very well control. So then he had to call in the Madison Police, and occasionally the sheriffs. And finally, the National Guard. And the major so-called blow-up was in 1967 in October, when there was the protest about Dow Chemical, and students, there were some non-students, took over the School of Business where they were interviewing. And because of the mobs there, and because they stopped movement of the students into the building and the faculty, and the police were called. And then it was very tense. You could know that it was crackling with danger. The air was electric. And as you watched it, you just wished that somehow the crowd could be dispersed. Because sure enough, some shoving took place. I don't know who was really wrong, but then the clubs came out, and then the tear gas was thrown.
Was this the first occasion tear gas was used?
Yes, I think this was the very first occasion for tear gas in October 67. So to see bloody heads and tear gas and the roar and screams of a crowd was not only disturbing, but it was the kind of thing that haunted you for a while.
Now, what was your role in this?
Very little. I stayed out of it. I was now a university dean for public services, which is a whole new field. I worked in research. I worked with helping to apply research on campus, fundamental and all, to business, industry, to government. And I also represented the president and the regents at meetings around the state and worked with the Board of Visitors. I worked with overseas developments. I was in a whole new sphere.
No longer is directly involved as students.
No, I was not involved as students at all. As a matter of fact, I made it a point not to be involved. We have a new dean of students, Joe Kaufman, who's doing a good job, and inherited, walked into a very tough situation. In fact, an almost impossible situation with all of these forces coming together. I did observe. I wanted to see some of it. I stayed far enough away so that some of them who knew me as a dean of students wouldn't be referring to me. But I did want to observe so that when I had the meetings around the state, I could say that I was there, and this is what I observed firsthand. And I also wanted to observe so that if the president and others wanted some consultation, if they did, I could do it on a basis of seeing what had happened.
What kind of reaction around the state did you get?
Oh, most unfortunate and bitter. Feeling that the university was getting out of hand, that these people who were here were probably the students that were making this kind of a protest and this kind of a riot, were anti-American, against the institutions that we revered, that many felt that they should just be expelled. Now, when I say many, I should not say a majority, for there were some polls taken at that time of attitudes toward the university, and still over 60% of the Wisconsin people, according to Bud Sharp, Professor Sharp's surveys, had confidence in the university and in the administration, that in spite of difficulties, things were being handled about as well as they could. But about 30% felt that the administration was in error, the faculty was in error, and the students were, and that this was not only a bad mark on a part of the university, but probably something we would never recover from. That was about 30%. I think it'd be interesting to look those figures up again.
Yes,
Dr. Sharp.
Yes, it would.
Yes, he made a survey. But the significant thing was 55 to 60% said, well, this is happening in other places too, at Yale, and Harvard, Chicago, California, Berkeley, and University of Wisconsin is one of the kinds of places that these extremists would go to get attention. And they said that this will pass, and we're against this fighting in Vietnam too. It's well that the students do have a protest. They're unwise in the way they're doing it, but you can't blame them for kicking. That was a lot of the response. But significantly, 55 to 60% said that all in all, things were being handled in good shape. But you heard a lot about that 30%.
Then I suppose. Well, and it didn't stop there either.
No, and it went on. Could we pick it up another time, though? Are, of course, as revealed in the memo concerning the egg-throwing incident, that three students were certainly involved. Actually, they were apprehended. They were brought before the disciplinary committee. They admitted their guilt, and action was therefore to be taken. Now that I have the memos and letters before me, I do recall the supplementary facts concerning this case of 1956. Governor Brennebaum, former Governor Brennebaum, then on the Board of Regents, and John D. Jones, also on the Board of Regents, were most upset about this incident. They felt that it was something that should not be treated in the usual fashion of student misconduct. It was their opinion that it needed, demanded, the attention of the Board of Regents. Consequently, the Board did give it attention at an executive session. And when it was over, it was agreed that special attention to this whole matter be given by the Office of the President. After that decision, President Fred asked me, since I was then serving as his assistant, to follow this matter personally. And I did. While President Fred was in Virginia during a few days in June, it seemed best, because of some communications by phone and some follow-ups of letters to the editor and all, that we see former Governor Rennebaum personally. But that was done. Professor Ide, who is chairman of the Student Conduct and Appeals Committee, joined me. We did see Oscar Rennebaum, and he was most upset about the whole matter, and wanted to be sure that several things happened. One, that the boys were given firm discipline. Two, that somebody followed up on their progress in making amends. And that three, a report come back on what had happened to him, to John Jones, and if need be, to the Board of Regents. His concern was that such a serious matter could just get lost in the shuffle of many other activities, duties, and responsibilities. And he maintained that it should be given a top priority and that someone should be designated to follow through. It turns out that Professor Ide and I both proposed that, we too proposed that there be someone designated. And Oscar Rennebaum said that it would be all right with him if I, as assistant to the president, making sure that the president of the university was well informed of everything going on, would be the one who would give it personal attention and would have the boys report to me. It was also his wish that we communicate directly with John D. Jones to let him know what was to be done. The report then was made specifying that the boys, upon recommendation of the Appeals Committee, would do some actual work, not be given the money, an amount of $200, to pay as a penalty, but that they would do some work for a commercial firm or a farmer or someone where they would surely be required to check in and check out and put in a full day's work. The more difficult the job, the better. So they did agree, that the committee agreed, and the boys were informed of this. They did do the work. They did various jobs. They reported them to me, and they also made their payments as rapidly as they could.
Did you say it was $200?
$200. They paid in varying amounts. Finally, in early 1957, the boys had not only had good records, stayed out of trouble, but had made their payments, and their payments were made with funds which they had earned by doing manual work and other duties. They also consulted with me. They came in to see me, and I made sure that their record was good, checking with their advisors and with campus protection and security to be certain that, as far as we knew, there had been no other episodes. It all ended with satisfaction. In order to go on to the law school, Mr. Krinker did have some difficulty because he was on probation, disciplinary probation. He had to be cleared from that. He also wanted to get some work done at UWM, and that was a bit difficult to get there without having the probation follow him. We did see that he was cleared of that probation before he left. I'd never heard of these fellows after that, for I went to the governor's office in January of 1957, and a man who replaced me, Mr. William Thomas, followed up on the final details. Perhaps the essential part of this is that a governing board was incensed, even angry, at having students or anyone else, in this case students, throwing eggs at officers and men in uniform who were parading on an armed forces day. The regents felt this was insulting, and that if something was not done, that these young men were not disciplined, that if there wasn't a careful follow-up, we could have a very dangerous trend of disrespect for the flag, for the uniform, and for the federal government.
I suppose it wasn't too good for the university's image either.
No, no, and we did have editorials. We did have headlines. There was much concern around the state, letters to the editor, but there were there was not much concern on the part of the faculty. The Conduct and Appeals Committee, Professor Ide and his group, principally wanted to get the matter over. They understood the regent's concern, but they felt it was a mistake, and they did point out, as I recall now, after the hearings were over with these students, that we did have the engineering parades and that eggs were thrown, and it was considered something of a lark. In fact, everyone looked with amusement at the engineers throwing eggs at the law students in retaliation for the eggs that the law students had thrown at them in the first place. So faculty and students didn't feel it was a matter of top priority, but the regents did, and Dr. Fred responded, and he felt that this should receive attention of the president's office. So this was a most unusual procedure. Very rarely was a conduct case taken out of the hands, which in this case it really was,
of
the Committee on Conduct and Appeals, and referred to the president's office. We did, in keeping with Dr. Fred's policies, do our utmost to keep in touch with the Conduct and Appeals, so we didn't have a schism there and didn't have some demarcation of president's office, administration, versus the faculty committee. But we did keep in touch with Professor Ide, and now as I recall, while I was delegated to go to see Oscar Renneborn, representing the president, to confer about this matter, I asked Oscar if it wouldn't be all right for me to bring the chairman of the Conduct and Appeals Committee with me, and he agreed. Of course, this was well after the event, a couple months after the event, and I remember, too, that Professor Ide handled the matter very, very successfully. He was low-key, he was patient, he agreed that it was a most unfortunate thing. He said we must not allow it to happen again. He wanted to be sure on behalf of the committee that these young men were given proper penalties, that this would be something they would never forget as long as they live. And when Professor Ide, in his dignified, careful fashion, was through, Oscar Renneborn said, "Well, I think that you fellows are going to handle this just right." But then he gave us one more blast about just too much liberalism and too much disrespect for the flag. And after that was over, we went to the business of working out the procedure. Another sidelight on this is that in 1949, at the annual review of the ROTC. It was either 1949 or 1950 when we had a great number of young men in ROTC because it was required. A group paraded around Camp Randall Stadium, in fact, inside, protesting ROTC, protesting the military. And Oscar Renneborn, then governor, was there. And he was bitter and angry about this demonstration, the kind of things we take in stride now. But in 1949, shortly after World War II, when patriotism of that kind was very high, Oscar Rennebaum spoke vigorously about it and was most unhappy and said so to everyone who would listen. I think this was 1950. It turned out that just about a day later, we had the Reserve Officers Association meeting in Madison, the state meeting, and I was the presiding officer, and Oscar Rennebaum was there. And I recall that he got up at that meeting and condemned the action that happened out of Camp Randall.
The protest.
The protest. And got great applause from the Army officers who were there assembled. So this 1956 episode fitted in a bit with the episode of 1950.
It's certainly consistent.
Yeah.
Was the kind of the form of the discipline that was decided on
most unusual for students to be required to do a given amount of work, a specified work, to earn the money was unusual. It is a little bit the kind of thing that you might have done in grade school or high school now as we look back. I don't think you could possibly do it in 1974, but in 1956, it was possible to do it. So this was unusual, first, that students would be required to make a payment to a scholarship.
Is that where it went?
That's right. A student scholarship. A scholarship, I don't remember, but it was to assist other students. And secondly, that the payment would come not from a father's purse, but from hard work which would be identified as full work and during the summer session or the time when they normally wouldn't be in classes. And further, unusual that students would be reporting not to a dean of men or to a dean of women, but would be reporting to the office of the president of the university. And further, that there would be a direct communication to the governing board, the Board of Regents. So that was very, very different. Actually, if you took all of the disciplinary cases and had them all handled that way, you'd have to have a whole corps staff for the president to do that work, and the regents would be spending a major share of their time hearing conduct cases. And that would be unwise in many respects because you would be interfering with faculty rights and students' rights and privileges. You would also be having the administration reaching down into faculty-student affairs unwisely. And in addition, there was a competent staff of counselors, advisors, faculty Committee on Student Conduct and Appeals that was all equipped to do exactly that kind of thing. So one episode could be handled without undue interference. But if we had two or three more, there might have been a real shakedown to decide, well, really, who is running this kind of thing for the university. Now I recall, too, that I did meet with President Fred and with Ira Baldwin. Ira Baldwin is then vice president of the university, and we all agreed that since I was designated, that I would follow up, but we would keep it all as low-key as possible. All three of us were pleased that we'd come out of it as well as we had.
That's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember the 51, the 1949 or 1951 so very well, because I was presiding.
Well, perhaps now we might continue with I guess we were talking about the beginnings of the really serious
yes,
protest movements at the university, and you talked about the Dow incident a bit. as being the beginning of, well, first time tear gas was used and so forth. I was wondering.
That was 1967 October.
I was wondering what your opinion was of the way it was handled, whether you had any criticism of the administration's actions, specifically of Mr. Fleming's.
It's very easy to criticize with hindsight. And I suspect that Bob Fleming would also criticize the action, since he had to take action under fire and without much chance to have reflection or to make referrals to a faculty committee. And, of course, he did decide to take action personally. If I were to criticize now about it, I think the major mistake was for Bob Fleming, then the provost of the Madison campus, the assignment now we call chancellor. I guess he was called chancellor then.
A little something different.
Yes, I think he'd been called chancellor. They changed the title from provost to chancellor. A small matter. But he did work with just a select small group of angry, violent protesters. And certainly, they were not elected. They were not the chosen by the whole campus. At that time, we had at least 22 to 25,000 students on the Madison campus. And these people didn't represent student government. They didn't represent any major group on the basis of a motion or an action or a ballot of any kind, even a popular opinion poll. They simply took all of this onto themselves and invaded the chancellor's office. They threw papers around. They made demands of him. And the chancellor responded to them. They had their leaders, Mr. Cohen and others, and he had debates with Mr. Cohen. And the chancellor would come out to the press and give his report, and then Mr. Cohen would come out and give his report. And Mr. Cohen and his group allowing the chancellor to come in to his own office when they were good and ready to have him come in. I think the mistake recognition of a major amount to these protesters and actually to consider that they spoke for the whole student body, which they did not. Now, how he could have handled them without aggressiveness and the fact that they were right on the end of their. But he did have serious discussions with them. He responded to their confrontations. And I just have a feeling that if he were here with us today to be in this conversation, he would agree that it was unwise, in retrospect, to treat this group of belligerents who broke in and broke all of the normal lines of conduct, as if they were the total campus. I think another mistake at that time was not to have brought in the recognized student government deliberately. Now, he did some. He communicated with the president of the student government. But I think, again, in retrospect, this would have been the time to call in the established student senators who were elected and their president who represented the leadership and talk to them and perhaps arrange for a discussion, too, with the leadership of the faculty so that there would be the chosen elected representation of faculty and students together with administration. And then that group that were reliable, were responsible, and were chosen in a proper fashion give attention to this very serious matter, and then report in an orderly fashion to this group what the decision was of those who were elected by the total faculty student community. For going around this whole group brought about, going around the elected students, going around the elected faculty, yes, he did, brought considerable confusion about who was in charge, who was responsible. And so Mr. Cohen, the belligerent who broke into the office, spoke to the press, to the nation, as if he really were the total student body and a good share of the faculty. And it was a matter of Cohen versus Fleming. Furthermore, Mr. Kaufman, Dean Kaufman, the Dean of Students, an able man here on the campus now, and a very sensitive fellow, Bob Fleming, is also very sensitive, very really close to the pulse of the students. They were unhappy about the Vietnam War. They were unhappy about the way we got into the war. They were feel for the attitudes, for the persuasions, for the commitments, for the general attitudes of faculty and students. And if they had communicated with them, they would have had a very warm response, as it was, in spite of all of the confusion. I think that Dean Kaufman and Chancellor Fleming did have the respect of the faculty and total student body, and generally went along. But the fact that they didn't go that channel brought difficulties not only for 1965-66, but much of the problem of 1967, I feel, came funny from having broken those lines of communication and from broken that steady response that comes from the orderly elected student and faculty groups.
Certainly there was a lot of confusion. And you're mentioning the faculty. There were faculty teach-ins and things.
Oh, yes. There's no doubt the faculty, whether it was a majority or not, it'd be hard to say, but certainly a major segment of the faculty wanted to protest our part in Vietnam. They wanted to protest the Dow Chemical business of the Met Palm. They wanted to protest the right of the Dow Chemical people to come here to recruit. They were expressing their, let's say, disgust, actually, with the Vietnam situation by being a part of the sit-in, so students could listen, could participate, and there could be that rapport of student faculty members working together to try to find some answer to this quandary that we were in. So this was a chance, it seemed to me, to capitalize on the structure that was there rather than to ignore it. Go around and talk to the whole group of belligerents, 50, 60, or 70, even a couple hundred, which is less than 1% of the whole student body, and communicate with them as if they were in charge, if they were really running.
Well, whether that was responsible or not, we do know that the situation got a lot worse before it got better.
Yes, and of course, it's, again, I have to say how easy it is to sit here years later and in the calm that we now have, and look back and say, this is the way it ought to be done. The action was absolute. To catch the heat, or to react to the heat of that confrontation was just the way it should have been done. Perhaps with Bob Fleming and Dean Kaufman right in the center of things, maybe we had a degree of support we might never have had if he had chosen to dodge it and not meet with it. but gone about. It could be that if we shake it all down and let him speak for it too, or let Kaufman speak for it, maybe the fact that they met the situation head on by a confrontation and by having some communication with these belligerents, maybe they got a respect and a rapport with the faculty and with the students and the state that they might otherwise not have had. You can't deny that there is some recognition of courage and poise and sense of command when any top administrator will allow himself to walk right in to what is known to be a red-hot situation and not duff it.
That's very true. However, things didn't really quiet down, and Fleming left. Do you think that this had situation, this whole situation, had something to do with his leaving?
I think so. I feel, too, that Bob Fleming, who had the charisma and the poise and internal strength to face a mob, to face belligerents, with some degree of success, made it very difficult for a man such as Bill Sewell, who succeeded him, who did not have that kind of skill or that kind of desire to meet with people under those conditions. Bill Sewell, a fine scholar, indeed a gentleman, and highly regarded by the faculty, a man of considerable stature in his field, but one who had never been in the negotiating of with labor, such as Bob Fleming, or one who had not had the kind of attributes to deal with in a mob situation. So he moved in then, following Bob Fleming, and immediately the confrontations came, but he was unprepared for it. This was not his strength. This was not his interest, and he was caught not only unprepared, but he was caught without the tools to do the job.
Well,
I'm not sure, but this confrontation in October 1967, when we had tear gas and had police damaged and students slugged, might have happened with Bob Fleming too. But I doubt it. I think had he stayed here, and he was learning all the time, he was getting more and more experience, learning how to work with police, learning how to work with the sheriffs, learning how to anticipate what the revolters, the revolutionary force would do. I think he could have prevented that kind of a major setback for all of us. That is, the head cracking and the tear gassing of 1967.
Well, that year of 67-68, I guess, was when Sewell was chancellor, was a pretty stormy year, and of course,
all over the United States.
Everywhere, yes.
We have to be fair about that. Berkeley campus, Chicago campus, Harvard, Columbia especially.
I'm wondering, given the climate of the times, why and with, as you said, Sewell's lack of experience with this type of situation, why he was appointed chancellor to succeed Clement.
Well, that's a major question that involves many things other than student matters. I don't know exactly why he was chosen. I'm not sure Bill Sewell today knows exactly why he was chosen. But there were many people being considered as successors to Bob Fleming. And there was every wish on the part of Fred Harrington, as far as I know, then the president, to recommend a man to the Regents who had undoubted support of the faculty. Harrington recognized the need for faculty support. And Sewell was highly regarded by the faculty, had been on the university committee, and I believe he'd been chairman of the university committee. So here is a man, a researcher, a teacher of international recognition, a personable man, warm-hearted, highly regarded in every respect, with fine personal attributes, and it would seem then that he could be the spokesman for the faculty. And now we would have a chancellor on the campus who would have not only understanding of the faculty, but strong support of the faculty in light of the difficulties which we knew might come. I think that was it. But Bill will have to speak. Fred Harrington will have to speak. And probably a couple who were on the Board of Regents and the Personnel Committee. I can only make an estimate of it from the outside.
That's what I was hoping you would do.
Yes.
It certainly was a unique situation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It really seemed like a good idea, you know, as you look back on it. I can understand that part of it in a man of the faculty.
Well, as we know, Bill Sewell was not happy, and he chose not to remain as chancellor.
It's just 1 year later, I believe it was in June or July of 1968, that he very suddenly resigned, and his resignation was accepted. There was a real strain there between the president of the university, Fred Harrington, and Bill Sewell.
That developed during that year?
That developed, right in those last weeks. Now, what the cause was, I don't know. Here again, I guess we'll have to get the people who are right close. I didn't realize, as a member of the president's staff, that there was this tension.
You didn't?
No, I was not aware of it. Oh, I knew that the president of the university wanted a man as chancellor to manage things, to control things, and to keep them in hand. And to be skillful enough to avoid major confrontations and to get faculty support, community support, statewide support, and even student support to really get things in perspective and get a handle on it. And yet these problems kept coming, and of course, the October matter was paramount. But I was not aware that there were these clear tensions to the point where the chancellor would walk in and tender his resignation. He was maybe surprised, I don't know, to find that it was accepted right there and then, and that he was asked when he wanted to leave, and he said, right now. And I think he did. I think he just walked out the very next day, which was usually there's a termination period of a month or so, or sometimes even a year. But this was very abrupt.
Well, my memory at the time was that it came as a surprise to the university as a whole.
Yes.
The suddenness of it.
I was driving to a meeting in northern Wisconsin. I heard it on the radio, and I was dumbfounded. If someone had said there was an argument, I could have understood that. But that he resigned and the resignation immediately accepted it was, to me, unconscionable.
Well, maybe we can find out more about that someday.
I'm sure you will. That's a very important part of university history, what happened there.
Well, I'll work on it then.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Just a minute to something you said a while back about changes of regulations in regard to student housing and so forth.
There were many.
You had something that you were telling me about.
Indeed. One which certainly is clear in my mind has to do with the situation which related to regulations concerning men living in housing units where there were single women. That is, a man could live in a home where there was a husband and wife, or he could live in a home where there was a male in charge. But he could not live in a home where there was a single woman without special permission. And to my attention then came a man here from Australia studying for his doctorate. In fact, he was a professor in Australia. And he asked for special consideration, where he lived with in a home where there were two elderly women, both unmarried at the time. And as he stated it, he didn't see why he couldn't have this privilege. As he said, really, you know, I have no inclination whatever in respect to these elderly women. He felt there would be no romantic interest whatever. I relayed this to the Dean of Men, Dean Zellman, who really was in charge of any of these major changes. That is, he was chairman of the committee, the Student Appeals Committee and Conduct Committee. And he protested my action because he said, if you make this exception for this man to live with single women, then you've got to do it for others. I tried to point out that this was indeed a most exceptional case, a man of mid-years living with these two quite elderly women. In fact, he had to look out for them, and they were lucky to
they
have
were
him.
That elderly.
Yes, lucky to have him to clean the walks and do other things around the house. But Dean Zellman again maintained that if you make that kind of an exception, then the next ones will get closer and closer, and soon you'll break the rule. Well, it did seem ridiculous to me, and it seemed that surely an exception ought to be made, and so it was left that if Dean Zellman wanted to appeal over my head, he should then see the president. It was not done.
He did not appeal.
He did not appeal. It ended there. But I must point out, in fairness to Dean Zellman, that there was a major block of faculty members who would back him up in that kind of an interpretation, because they felt that a rule was a rule and we should not make exceptions. And while it may have seemed ridiculous to a lot of the faculty to have this situation exist, nonetheless, there were actually hundreds of faculty members, as revealed in later test cases, who would have said, Dean Zellman did the right thing. So, for the record.
But the gentleman from Australia could stay.
Yes. Now, all of this, of course, is highlighted by today, where we now have the Regents just taking action last Friday, authorizing hard liquor to be served in residence halls.
Yes, I read about that, and yes, there's sure. criticism of this decision.
Oh, indeed. And so now we have no hours for men, which we didn't have. We have no hours for women. We have men and women living in the same unit, although not on the same floor. We have authorization to serve beer, and now we have authorization to serve hard liquor. So it's a long, long way in a very few years.
How do you feel about this recent decision about the liquor?
I'm opposed. I think that the one who wants to have hard liquor can go out and get it. There are places.
Well, now, and particularly that the age has been lowered to
yes,
18.
To 18. They can go out and get it. I have particularly in mind the young man or woman who really doesn't want to be around it. There are boys and girls who at 18 and 19 are still very young, and they have had a home situation which really wouldn't prepare them for being around those that consume liquor, who can show off, or who can be tired, or can have just plain bad habits and bad manners. And suddenly they're confronted with not necessarily drunkenness, but with excessive consumption. And the results of it can be embarrassing and annoying and really quite disturbing to the student who doesn't want to be around that kind of thing and really isn't ready for it. If that 17 or 18-year-old or 19-year-old was 4 or 5 years older or traveled or been in military service and then came back, that student could take it in stride. But I think some people sure of this. We know this is true. 18-year-olds can be quite boys and girls rather than young men and women quite at that time. There are differences in maturity, considerable differences. And in light of that, I think it puts quite a strain on a student that doesn't want to be around hard liquor, isn't ready for it, and now faces it. So I would have voted against it. I would have voted for opening the housing regulations. I did that. I think that's another matter. That has its problems, too. And I think beer is a little different. One can get high on beer, to be sure, but they have to drink much more of it. And it doesn't have the immediate effect of 3 or 4 ounces of hard liquor. Mm-hmm. That's my opinion. I would have been voted down.
Yes, they passed it. So mm-hmm. We'll see what now comes of it.
So off the record, I think that the administration was very worried about this. And I don't think we've heard the last of it. I think we're going to get repercussions from this. But you even have the situation in Pipeville where Bjarne Elsvik, the chancellor, not many years ago, in fact, I think not over 7 years ago, felt that he was going all out to allow beer to be sold at the student union. And now here he was, just these few years later, being one of those that spoke in favor of having hard liquor served or available in the dormitories.
That's an interesting change of view.
Yes.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what now comes of all this.
Mm-hmm.
Watch
mm-hmm.
what
and I can be quite
develops.
Wrong. I can be quite wrong. But that would be my opinion as of now.
That's what I asked you.
Yeah.
Now, perhaps, there are a number of other things about your days as Dean of Students that I'm interested in, but since we've started talking about the whole protest movement, so to speak, maybe we might as well go on with that and then return later to some of these other questions. We did talk about the Dow recruiting incident and something about the sit-ins, Dow Chemical, and something about the sit-ins, a little bit about the teach-ins.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the situation didn't get better for a while. It got worse. And Fleming did, in fact, resign, as you described. And I guess you might say that, in a way, it kind of all culminated in the bombing of Sterling Hall.
One or could say that.
Do you feel that way? I know this wasn't the end of it, protests continued, but...
No, it was not the end. The protests did continue, but not in the fashion that they did prior to August of 1970, to the bombing of Sterling Hall. It would have to be my opinion, in reflection, that all of these protests did finally culminate in something which had to be very, very serious. You could feel it coming, that something would occur which could cause the loss of life or the loss of major property. And surely that happened in the bombing of Sterling Hall. The protests, the opposition to our participation in Vietnam, and the fact that many faculty members engaged in protests, the fact that it seemed to be a way of life, it seemed to be the thing to do, probably gave these young men who did the bombing a feeling that they were doing something that was right. They were helping, they felt, to stop a war. And they were helping to stop it by some major, vigorous, in their thinking, clever and courageous act. Now we know that a life was lost, massive property loss. We are lucky to come out of it as well as we did. There could have been 25
more.
Or 30 people killed. There could have been $20 million of property destroyed. There could have been research work lost that had taken centuries almost to build up. But that did not occur. Certainly, one life is too much to lose, and one building is too much to lose, although I don't compare them. The life is a thing that must concern us most, naturally. If there had not been the protests on this campus, if there had not been that kind of climate, I doubt if these young men would have taken it on themselves to dynamite a structure. So you can say that it's an accumulation of attitude, of confidence in their act, of justification in their act, and maybe even a feeling, as they said later, of righteousness, that they were doing the thing that America had to get done, and that they were doing something in which they really acted for, they spoke for, the major segment of the student body. Well, after all, the Daily Cardinal, for whatever that's worth, did defend their act. And many in student government defended their act. Significantly, very few faculty spoke in favor of their act. Very few. As I can recall now, I don't remember a single one who identified himself or herself as justifying this action. Now, there may have been a few. I'm a bit hazy on that. But I can't recall any leading faculty member who stood up to say, it's too bad, we lost a life, but these boys did the right thing.
How do you explain this? Generation gap or something else?
Well, after all, the faculty could see here the invasion of their own work. Here was one of their own structures gone. Here was one of their own students gone. Yeah. I suspect, too, that they recognized that this could mean the closing down of a university. Not that they're thinking necessarily of their bread and butter, but I think they could see now in this dramatic fashion, this act, that there could be the closing down of the whole university, or the student part of it. In fact, that was proposed, you know, that in light of this, who knows how many other bombs there will be. We better close down now before other lives are lost. And it is my belief that many of the faculty then began to talk about it, and those that didn't talk about it began to understand just how serious this was and how serious it was to them personally. Now it really came home. So they took no part in it. And further, I think that since this was an act of destroying some federal equipment and state equipment, that they did not want to get on record as in any way being in favor of this, so that they would be brought into hearings or brought into court. After all, faculty do have more perspective. They ought to have. And I think that made a difference. At any rate, there was no major faculty action of any kind, as there was in the Dow Chemical before, and as there was in other instances of protest. Here, there was none.
Well, part of the problem there, of course, had to do with the fact that, isn't it true that the Army Math was located,
yes,
at that time in Sterling Hall?
Yes.
And subequently, they have moved their headquarters out
That's
to the
right.
Wharf
building.
Mm-hmm. What do you know of the administration and or regent reaction to this, and why did they? To the bombing and to the business, what to do about the Army Math Center, which was the sort of focus of this.
Immediately after the bombing, the regents did come in. The president of the regents, Bernie Ziegler, arrived the next morning, was here to survey it with Chancellor Ed Young, and Bernie Ziegler made the statement immediately that it was destructive and it was shocking. It was tragic that the university work would have to go on. And that was the feeling of the regents, that with all of the trauma and all of the disaster, the university work would continue. And that was, of course, exemplified by the university hospitals, where the work went on. The very next day, operations were made. nurses came on duty, the doctors came on duty, and the research work continued. While there was still smoke and rubble, the hospitals continued their work. I think that was indicative of the attitude of the whole campus. And the regent spoke in glowing terms about that kind of dedication and that kind of poise and courage on the part of the staff. Following up, the regents too felt that it would be, well, I guess I can't speak precisely why they moved to Warren.
Well, I wondered if it was some sort of reaction to this or whether there had been a plan all along for this kind of thing.
I'm not sure, but I suspect that they thought it was right along to go out to Warp and as a possibility. And certainly it took the pressure off. Rather than to go right down in the very center where Sterling Hall is, in the heart of the campus, it took the pressure off from what could be an attention on the part of the student protesters to put it out at Warp, which is a half a mile or so away. I think it was a good decision. Precisely why they did it, I do not know. But I think it was a good decision to go out to war.
Well, again, in hindsight, at least things have calmed down in relation to this particular activity.
Yes.
And they did, even while the protests were still going on the campus, to my memory.
Oh, yes. Alumni Research Foundation worked with the Mass Center, and the Mass Center went right along. There was no real break, except for equipment loss. And as I remember, too, they didn't get all of the Army Mass Center equipment. They damaged some, but they really didn't destroy it.
Well, there were other things located in Sterling Hall, and I guess there was damage to a lot of the physics.
Yes. Over $1 million of destruction. Equipment. Some said $1.5 million. Yes, there was work in physics that was destroyed. By the way, I said that there was, could have been very damaging to have had a lot of research work destroyed. There was research work destroyed in this bomb, as I remember now. How much, I can't say, but there were valuable papers lost.
Well, just going back to your statement that, you felt that the individuals involved in this had felt that they had a kind of mandate of sorts.
Yes.
That they were protesting.
That's what they said.
It is true, is it not? at least my impression was that from the trial of Carlton Armstrong, the only one who's been tried so far, that they tried to show that it was a political issue.
Yes.
I guess they didn't succeed in proving this, but no, this was the effort.
And lawyers, in fact, I think even former Senator Greening, whatever the pronunciation is, from Alaska, an elderly man, came all the way to Madison to indicate that he thought it was a political issue. Therefore, it would have to be considered as such. Of course, they had some strong attorneys making that point. Again, I don't believe there was a single university faculty member who came down to make that statement, and that's significant. They were noticeably quiet.
Well, to go on, there were incidents after that. There were still some protests.
Yes.
But a considerable amount of steam, I guess, was removed when
the numbers got much less. In 1971, there was a protest. But rather than have 4,000 and 5,000 and 6,000 students out in townspeople, there were only about a couple hundred. And they marched to the Capitol, but it was on the sidewalks and quite peaceful. The real power, the force of the protests now was diminished markedly.
But they still had the National Guard out in force, and I recall seeing all sorts of vehicles.
After 1970?
after, yes, as late as, I would say, the spring of 1971.
It certainly hit them out in 1968 and 69. There were National Guard on.
Even, I think it was the spring of 71.
The spring of 70 was major. That's when we had the teaching assistant TA strike, and that's when they had the Kent State problem and the one in the South. And then the National Guard was out, and we had a major problem on the campus. It was really very tense. So tear gas, and at night it seemed almost like combat with helicopters overhead, at least one helicopter, and major searchlights used from the helicopter. So that was the spring of 1970. May I go back in my records, see how much the National Guard was called out after 1970, August?
Well, I seem to recall
it could well be
in the spring at least of 71, looking out the library windows and watching in the archives office vehicles of various sorts, mm-hmm. And tear gas. But I sort of feel this was perhaps about the end of it. I would be interested in knowing, people have commented about what they describe as a sudden shift in student reaction. Clearly, the cessation of our involvement in Vietnam had a lot to do with it. Do you think anything else has had anything to do with it? The sudden change in student attitude?
Oh, certainly, doing away with the draft. This took away a lot of the tensions and pressures. The students who were on the campus did not need to feel guilty, which I'm sure many of them did, that there were young people who couldn't be admitted to college or didn't choose to be in college or serving in the military and in Vietnam, while those that were in college were freed of that responsibility. That made a difference, doing away with the draft. I think another major reason was that the students began to see that these protest leaders were really using them, that the protest leaders wanted to do the kind of destruction or the kind of breakdown of society or education in their own fashion, and that these leaders needed to have the backing of a main body of students, and then that these leaders would lead the students, a thousand or more, in a protest. And then when the police came, the leaders would disappear, and the students who were there following sincerely would be picked up and would be embarrassed or harassed. And the students began to get onto that they were used, that the leaders manipulated them. And when they understood that these fellows that would get up to the microphones and do all the haranguing and all of the writing, where somehow all was disappearing when the police came, and that these folks who were sincere about it and followed were the ones that paid the penalty. That got to be pretty old stuff, and soon there became that reaction against it. I think that was a major factor. Plus, still another, I think, was just getting tired of it. It became a wearisome thing. It went going on and on. And students begin to worry now, too, about getting jobs, getting placements, and the fact that many were being apprehended and fined, and police records are not a good thing to have. So that was related to the difficulty in getting jobs. So it's another factor, two or three here, all going along. The need to have a good record to apply for a job. And jobs were not as plentiful. So this steadied things down, and this made them more conservative, perhaps we should say more cautious. Still another factor was that the high school kids began to pick up the protest business. And traditionally, when high school youngsters pick up an act that the college students have done, the college students then begin to lose interest in it.
That's an interesting point. Yes. I hadn't thought of that.
Yes. This, This makes it juvenile rather than major, an adult. So those would be the several observations I would make.
This is not exactly on the same subject, but it's perhaps related. It was the same kind of activity. I was thinking of the Mifflin Street protest, the block party that went awry as it was denied permission and all the confrontation with the city police. You feel this sort of was related to all this other tension?
Oh, yes. Quite a few of the leaders who were involved in the campus protests would also show up at Mifflin Street. Well, I say quite a few, not all, because a lot of these leaders that were on the Vietnam, the Dow Chemical and all, were many from out of the state of Wisconsin. They were not University of Wisconsin students.
Is this true? I've heard it rumored,
No doubt about it. They came and then disappeared or went on to Columbia or wherever they were going. In fact, some of them had a route from Berkeley to Madison to Ann Arbor and then to Columbia and possibly up to Harvard or Yale or Princeton. That was the route across the country. And some stopping off in Chicago. So I think that that did make a difference. These people who were the professionals, so-called, who dropped out. Let's see, you had another question along with that.
Well, I wondered if, basically, whether it was related to the...
Oh, to Mifflin Street, you were saying.
Yeah, Mifflin Street.
In part, it was part of the climate of protesting the establishment. And when you protest the establishment of the federal government or state government, when you go to Mifflin Street and protest the city government, that again is a part of the establishment. There also was the excitement, and I'm sure that it was just the fun of getting the police out. That is, now we didn't have the National Guard or the police on the campus for these protests, but there was some fun in having the kind of an action which would bring the police in and put them in a very undesirable situation, where the students could disappear up into the Mifflin Street apartments or Mifflin Street houses, and the police would be left there to be heckled and harassed. There was fun. Much of that was fun and games. And, of course, like fun and games with big crowds. Once the sirens wail and once the clubs come out, many people get hurt when they didn't expect to get hurt and didn't want to get hurt and protested that they had nothing to do with it. But they were just part of the crowd. Nothing new about it. This is always to me. Part of the crowd, you take a chance. And that was woven into it. These people that were a part of the crowd and took their chances. So there was no direct line of, as I observed, of the the Vietnam federal government protests, the Department of Defense protests, military, on the campus through to Mifflin Street, except that there was an attitude, a climate of opposing.
Well, in line with what you just said about fun and games, I do seem to remember reading a year or two later when a similar type of block party with a new mayor was approved and was held, that there were statements in the paper by some people saying, well, fun had all gone out of it.
And also when the chief of police, the new chief of police, entered in the parade. There was a peace parade carrying candles from the field house to the Capitol Square. And our new chief of police, Mr. Cooper, rather than feel that there had to be firm action taken to stop it or control it, was there in civilian clothes and carried a candle and walked with him. Which, again, took a lot of steam out of it. Now, his colleagues, some of his colleagues protested that. But we'll see. Nonetheless, there was no difficulty, and he was there. and Alderman Sotman was there.
Our mayor.
Now our mayor.